This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
You're listening to the Ann Campaigns Church Politics Podcast, where you can get in-depth political analysis from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be progressive or conservative. We're trying to be faithful Christians in the public square.
This is the kingdom. The kingdom. The kingdom. Yes, it is. Gotta spread the word.
What you know good, Ann Camp, you're listening to the Ann Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, that's me, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. Pastor Chris, how you doing today, man?
Oh, I am doing quite well indeed. Just celebrated my birthday. So
happy birthday.
Pretty good. Thank you, sir.
Now, is it my understanding that you actually share a birthday with Fannie Lou Hamer?
Yes, indeed. A few years earlier than me, Fannie Lou Hamer was born, but I do have the privilege of sharing a birthday with that legend.
That's special, man. That is special, man. Would have loved to be out there with you in Chicago. I know you got a lot of campaigning and stuff going on out there, man. I've had like a 5-city tour in the last week and a half. So it's been a crazy one for me. But I know something we both share is the joy of knowing that the Chicago Bears did pull off a win with Justin Fields as their starting quarterback last week. So that's something to be happy about.
Yes, indeed it is. And they put him in as a starter. So as long as they protect, I think I'm going to be happy about that.
Yeah, you got to protect the man. You know, if you can't protect the man, then just wait until you can. But hopefully they can do a little better. We shall see, man. We got a lot to talk about today, a whole lot to talk about today. So we might as well just go ahead and get into it. But as usual, Ann Camp, grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but like a Christian. Now, Emma Green, who writes on religion, culture, and politics for The Atlanta, had an article come out this week called "The Conservative Dreading and Preparing for Civil War." That's right, civil war. She interviewed Ryan Williams from the Claremont Institute, which is a conservative think tank. Their mission at the Claremont Institute is to restore the principles of the American founding to their rightful preeminent authority in our national life. They want to return to limited government and to save Western civilization. They generally seem to be Trump supporters. I think they're pretty clear about that. And it came out in the interview, Chris, that one of their fellows is a legislative assistant for Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. She is the QAnon supporter. Now, as you guys would imagine, I have a lot of disagreements with Ryan Williams and the Claremont Institute, but that should never stop us and never does stop us here at the AND campaign from wanting to be as charitable as possible, wanting to be fair. So I want to start off this conversation with that in mind. And so I have to start off by saying, I don't think, Chris, that the title of this article was fair. After I read it, it seemed to me that the title was overly provocative as to be inaccurate. And here's what I mean by that. The title makes it seem like Williams was talking about preparing for civil war most of the interview, as if that's what the interview was about and that's what he was bringing up and really taking a deep dive into. But when you read the article, he was really just responding to the last question of the interview, which was about violence. So I do want to start off by addressing that before we move forward. I didn't think that the title of this article was fair, but I think it was a telling article nonetheless. So the Claremont Institute, just to kind of dive into who they are, they believe that America has been divided into two fundamentally different countries. primarily because of the rise of secularism and the progressive movement. Williams says that the founders were pretty much unanimous that the Constitution is really only fit for a Christian people. That's an interesting statement to me, because number one, pretty much unanimous means that they weren't unanimous, number one. And then you also got to consider that they prioritize religious freedom, right? And not just religious freedom inside of Christianity. You also have to consider that they made a lot of space, even if they didn't use these exact words or say it, you know, how we talk about it today. They made a lot of space for civic pluralism. That mechanism that they created through the Constitution forces a type of pluralism. All right. And so I think hit that assertion, which is one of his main assertions in this conversation, is highly questionable, if not just downright false. But look, I digress. When you look at the article, what I got from it, Chris, is that he seems to primarily be worried about or concerned about the progressive movement's push for larger bureaucracy and what some would call kind of the administrative state, right? They're enlarging these bureaucracies, they're invading our privacy, invading all these other things. And he goes on to say that wokeism is a threat to limited government. He called it woke totalitarianism, okay? But a lot of his arguments, a lot of what he was saying was based on the Constitution, which he calls the U.S. Constitution a colorblind document, right? He says the U.S. Constitution was colorblind. This is another place where obviously, you know, you'd say, well, was it so colorblind, I guess, that it allowed slavery? I would hope that if we were to have a conversation that we could all kind of admit that the implications and the impacts of the U.S. Constitution were not colorblind. And did allow people to be treated differently. But again, I digress. I want to go deeper into this conversation. Based on the interview, the Claremont Institution's philosophy seems to be founded on this romanticized idea that we had an ideal country right after the creation of the Constitution. And then somehow these progressives came and tore it all apart. I mean, he conveniently glosses over slavery and the treatment of indigenous people, which, again, is not just a small blip in the history of America. It's something that you really have to deal with. And I'm one of those people that thinks the Constitution, just like Frederick Douglass, is a brilliant document that has had a lot of potential. But certainly I don't raise it to the point where he's raising it here. He tends, and you might have caught this too, Chris, he tends to talk about Christianity and limited government with seamless transitions, as if they're almost inextricably tied together, and they kind of just overlap. But the truth of the matter is, in my reading of history, and folks may disagree, and I'd love to hear what you have to say, limited government, as I understand it, didn't free the slaves. It didn't establish the Americans with Disabilities Act. It didn't prevent the financial crisis of 2008. And the regulations that should have been there that didn't protect the people. Furthermore, you all know, so, you know, this isn't just me defending progressivism. You all know that I have serious issues with the progressive movement. I don't disagree that there are some serious dangers there. And I've said that over and over again. And I'm sure I'll say it in the future. Namely, some of the problems that I have with it is its imposition of secular progressive values, such as kind of eroding parental rights and how it uses government and public education to further that goal. Me and Williams may have some agreement there. But I also know that the conservative movement is not perfect. I also know that the conservative movement did not end Jim Crow. It did not establish workers' rights. It did not fight for gender equality. The progressive movement did that. It's not historically just some evil brigade that ruined a once perfect country. And I think that's, you know, to set it up that way and to kind of make that the basis for a lot of the assumptions and direction of your organization is just bad. I don't like when progressives do that and act like conservatism is just some completely negative thing that's always just ruins everything and never wants to change anything. And I don't like when progressives paint that kind of picture, right? Again, it was progressivism that fought for civil rights. workers. Well, it was Christianity too, but as far as an ideology that had a hand in it, it was progressivism that was fighting for civil rights, for workers' rights, and for voters' rights. Limited government conservatism did not do that. And in fact, conservatives often fought against those things on the basis of federalism and limited government intervention. Again, the point is not to, we're talking about this particular article. The point is not to say that progressivism is great. If you listen to the last few podcasts that we have, episodes we've had, you know we don't think that. But we do have to push back against the idea also that conservatism is perfect and this country would be perfect but for how progressives came in and ruined it. That's just ahistorical, right? The federal government had to step in to protect people when individual states refused to do so. I myself am not against federalism. For those people wondering what federalism is, it's the idea that, you know, you have a separation of government and then state governments have all the powers that are not directly given to the federal government, right? That are not explicitly given to the federal government. Those are states' power and the state shouldn't intrude on that. That's true to a certain extent. I'm not against federalism. It can be helpful and it's great in theory, but I think we all have to admit that in practice, it has failed vulnerable communities, namely Black people in this country. Now, I'm about to hand it over, Chris, but let me say this. What stood out to me most in this interview is after all the talk about Christianity, after all the talk about truth and all this other stuff, he refused to critique his own tribe. When asked about QAnon, he refused to condemn QAnon. He refused to condemn those false conspiracies. When asked about Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, he refused to say that her antics were harmful to this democracy, to Western civilization, and all these things that he's saying he's trying to save. And so to me, a lot of this isn't about faith in God. It's about faith in power. It's about faith in the dark arts of politics. In some ways, this is almost faithless when it comes to a Christian point of view. This is, in many ways, the opposite of what the AND campaign promotes. But Chris, I just want to get your feeling on just on this article in general and that point of view coming from the Claremont Institute.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to start the same place you did because I think it is just particularly bad to me, and that's what the headline. And the reason that I start with the headline is just the same as you, in terms of it's not fair. I think a lot of folks would agree that it's not fair if you read the entirety of the piece. But beyond that, it is certainly, without question, not charitable. And I think that it is okay in this particular political moment to begin to sort of ask for that and require that in some ways in public discourse. Because one of the big things, if not the biggest thing that we're sort of working against right now in our democracy, in our public discourse, is this whole fundamental idea of hyper division, constant tribal warfare. And so when you have an interview like this, that is pretty substantive, that where you can make, you know, sort of challenges to the argument on the substance, it does us no favors to pull out the very most sort of salacious thing and make that the headline. And I'm talking about for those like me who would want to critique a lot of what we actually find in the piece itself. You touched on so many things. I'm not going to go back and repeat all of those things. I do want to point out a couple of things on this point of conservatism. And, you know, I'm not huge on, you know, waving flags and staking out territory in one camp or the other. But I don't think that it is necessarily the best conception of conservatism to put it forward as this idea that nothing should ever change. I don't think you have to be a progressive to understand that time doesn't go backward. Societies and people don't really flow backward, and that things indeed do change. And I think if you just take a sort of intellectually honest approach to the conversation, even as a conservative, you would admit to the fact that the country that we live in today is a little bit different from the one that the founders lived in. Now, I, like you, and I think like Williams, believe that the Constitution itself as a document is really profound, because in some way it dreams of a world that it really wasn't born into or born out of. And so I think there's a lot of capacity in the Constitution to still guide and govern here. But there's a mood in the conversation, at least the way I interpret it, that change itself has been bad in some way. And I don't think that you have to be a progressive to disagree with that concept. I think that there is a conception of conservatism that's more deeply connected to a set of ideals around what is true, what is of the most important value, and that there are sort of universal truths that do not change. But as we live up to those truths in greater and greater measure, stuff does change. And I don't think you got to be a progressive to make that argument.
And then the idea that we started off at the best place, right? Like we started off at a place that we have to get. No, maybe we started at a place where we needed to get closer to the truth, which is true in a number of areas. And I don't know that this ideology, philosophy allows
for that. And so that's, I think that's the second point that I want to look at. And that's this idea. You talked about how he sort of makes this seamless transition from limited government to Christianity, but also from limited government and Christianity to sort of, I guess, old school Westernism. There's a connection there, which I don't know that it is particularly good to tie Christianity so closely to Westernism. I don't want to go down that as much because we're talking about American democracy here. But there's some real danger, and I think even when you're talking about American democracy, there's some real danger in tying Christianity so closely to Westernism. Certainly Christianity was a major influence on Westernism, but Westernism is not a main influence or any influence at all on biblical Christianity. It didn't exist when the Bible and Christianity
And there seems to be some supremacy there, yeah. Right?
Right.
There seems to be some supremacy there. I mean, because if you think about historically, even when you're talking about the conquest and all this stuff, there was always this thought that true civilization and true knowledge only came from the Western civilization, and anything else was some kind of somehow lesser. And you almost see pieces of that here, but I'm gonna let you continue.
Yeah, no, I think it's really dangerous. And I won't go way into that, but you can't tie Christianity so closely to Westernism. And then the last connection that I'll point out is this really, really close tie, of the sort of Constitution and founders talk to this idea of hyperfederalism, as if at the early years of this country, there weren't anti-federalists and there weren't, you know, sort of Democratic Republicans. And both of those sort of ways of thinking did find a home in the Constitution, even, you know, in the debates of the framers and the very early leaders of this country. And so to sort of assert, which I think we have here, not directly, but again, if you take the whole thing in total, there's sort of an assertion here that all of the framers, all of the founders were these hyper-federalists. And so we just got to get back to hyper-federalism and everything is going to be okay. And again, like, I just don't think that's honest. I don't think that's an accurate reading of history from the very, very early debates in the United States, there was debate, you know, around, you know, how much the federal government should get involved state by state. And again, there have been tremendous failures with that. And I'm all about, you know, critiquing and making sure that we do not over apply the influence of federal government in the lives of people and even in the affairs of states. But I don't think it's fair to equate, you know, the framers, the founders, the Constitution as a solidly and unquestionedly hyper-federalist sort of way of thinking. From the very beginning of this country, federalist and anti-federalist have debated the role of federal government. And that debate continues. I think it's good and it's healthy.
Yeah, I mean, federalism has its merits, right? I mean, there is a value to that. And we can see that value and we can advocate for that value. But you can't walk away. But to your point, you can't just act like that the founder's intention was this federal this hyper federalism that he kind of mentioned. And you can't pretend that federalism hasn't failed at times. That if federalism didn't fail in a way that it was supposed to be right, then what would happen with slavery? What happens with Jim Crow and all these other things? You really have to answer that. And I think progressives have to answer to the fact that sometimes this big, overly large government can fail us in many different ways. For Christians, we shouldn't be so drawn to these ideas that we have to defend them at all costs. No, we say, you know what? I think this is valuable in this situation, but I can acknowledge where it goes wrong. And I think here you have him talking about federalism like it's just infallible and it's always served us well. And it just has not always served us well. But here's the other thing, and it kind of ties into what you were saying earlier, too. When he talked about Christianity, he often coupled it with the Constitution, almost as if the Constitution was like the Bible, right? Like that was the Bible, or it was this document that always led us to the right spot. If we could just get back to that, everything will be right. And it's almost like he got those two mixed up, the Bible and the Constitution. We both acknowledge the brilliance that went into creating the Constitution. Anybody who can't see this document as something that is just brilliant, you need to read it a couple more times. You need to read world history a couple more times and some other folks' constitutions that fell well short of what ours has. Is it perfect? No. But I don't know that he gets that. You know what I'm saying? You almost got the feeling like this was this document that it was just, and it's like, man, we got to be a little more critical. Like, I get why that's a strong argument and an easy argument, but it's a very flat argument and a historical argument when you dig into it. So that's one thing that I was
I think if I could just, because I think that piece too, Justin, is like so, it's a little bit dishonoring to God if you think about it. When I look at our Constitution and I look at the sort of biographies of the men who formed it and just how really fallible and broken they were, you really have to make an argument that they achieved something that was beyond themselves, right? As a believer, I'm inclined to support the fact that maybe God really was up to something right there. But if you take that argument, then you just glorify God for some incredible stuff that happened with some really ragtag people, which is what God always does. But when you try to lift up the document to an unfair place, when you try to lift up even those.
So you're saying that every word of the Constitution was not breathed from
that God. Is not like, what it's I'm not, saying. It's not. And you got to, okay. I think that folks like understand that, like those of us who are believers know that like God will help you give you ideas that you wouldn't put in canon of scripture, but you'd be like, man, like God help me with that. I believe that, you know, that God truly is sovereign in the affairs of man. And I just argue, why not then just glorify God for whatever he was doing in that moment, which we do not know in totality because we still only know in part. But it's an opportunity to just say glory to God instead of glory to the Constitution and glory to the framers.
No, that's good. That's good. I mean, it's tough. And I want to be charitable. I've given some interviews where either the questions didn't lead me to say everything I wanted to say, or I got done with it. I got done with it. And I'm like, maybe I came off a little too strong on that point when my overall thought process or ideology doesn't lead me to think that. So that's a possibility here too. But when we talk about the point made at the end of the article about violence and about possible civil war, and I do want to point out that he said, you know, this is not something he wants to happen. He dreads that we might have to go to a point of violence, but it's still like, why are we, you know, why do we think we're there right now? And there's so much fear of this, of secularism and of the progressive movement, that I think it's very unhealthy. And this is for people on both sides of the conversation who have this fear of progressives or this fear of conservatives. Understand this, and especially when we're talking about the division in this country and possible violence, we can hate or fear something, someone, or some group of people so much that we start to anticipate and prepare for the worst. And in that anticipation, in that preparation, we actually become the ones who are bringing about this worst case scenario, right? It's the person that's in a relationship, for example, it's a person who's in the relationship who's so insecure, so afraid of getting hurt or the relationship ending badly, that they end up being the one to destroy the relationship out of anxiety and paranoia, out of fear. And that's what I see happening when it comes to a lot of conservatives and progressives. They're anticipating this so much that they're actually the ones that are bringing it about because they're so insecure and paranoid about it, right? Instead of being committed to persuading, now they feel like this is going to fall apart, it's inevitable, now they have to compel. And when you go from persuasion into compulsion, you're actually the one that's bringing about this worst case scenario. And so I would just keep that in mind, Ann Camp, as we go about these conversations. Where is your faith? Is your faith in power? Is your faith in being in power? Or is it your faith in something that it doesn't really matter who's in control in this world? Your faith has something greater. We'll be back. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. This is Justin Gibney. I'm sitting here with the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. And we're going to stay on the constitutional theme. We're going to stay on this theme of possible civil war, as scary as that may seem. The Washington Post columnist Robert Kagan recently wrote an article entitled, "Our Constitutional Crisis is Already Here." It starts with a James Madison quote that says, "Is there no virtue among us? If there be not, we are in a wretched situation." Kagan, who, like Williams, considers himself a conservative, but a different conservative, says the U.S. is headed into the greatest political and constitutional crisis since the Civil War, with a reasonable chance of mass violence and the division of the country into blue and red enclaves. Now, he gives us a reason for this. He says there are two reasons that he thinks this is the case. Number one, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee for president in 2024. Number two, Trump will not accept a loss. He will not accept a loss. He has undermined the system with the Stop the Steal effort. He's also removed Republican officials that disagreed with him. And many of his supporters control local elections in several states. All right. Kagan says also that the political and intellectual establishments have underestimated Trump's popularity and his hold on his followers, that they've underestimated this from the beginning and continue to do so. Now, those are some compelling reasons, and he might be right on those two points. Something I would add to it, Chris, is that my guess is that the left might not accept a loss either if Trump wins. And I think this is primarily because he won't win the popular vote. And so people will basically use that to say, hey, I'm sick of this system. It's, you know, it's ruled by a minority and this has to end. And that's when you get into these mass violent, you know, this mass violent, these huge protests and all this stuff, man. It could happen. And here's a few questions. You know, when he talks about our constitutional crisis is here, here's what he's kind of getting into. All right. He asked these questions. He says, what happens when there are mass protests across the country? Would governors call the National Guard, right? Governors of each state call the National Guard. Would Biden nationalize the Guard? If he did nationalize the Guard, that would be seen as tyranny in many of the states. Again, we're going back to this federalism conversation where states have their rights and they, you know, unless it was directly given into the federal government, those are states' rights that they maintain. All right. Kagan is saying that the Constitution offers no remedy for this crisis, right? No remedy. The Constitution has no remedy for the crisis that I just explained. And he says that most Americans and most politicians are not taking this possibility seriously. He says that Trump almost pulled off a coup. He said that Trump was two state attorney generals and a vice president away from staging a coup. I'm going to say that again. Trump was two attorney generals, one of those being in Georgia, and a vice president Pence, away from staging a coup. But they had enough integrity not to go along with him. Kagan says that these were not the checks and balances the framers had in mind when they drafted the Constitution. He said they did not foresee the Trump phenomenon. They didn't anticipate that party, that national party solidarity would transcend state borders. Kagan suggests that there is a remedy, although it's not constitutional. He says that the remedy is forming a national unity coalition where senators like Romney and more moderate Republicans form this coalition related to elections to make sure that 2024 doesn't go off the rails, that they need to come together and say, hey, whatever happens, we're going to make sure that we take care of business. Chris, should we take this? Is there a constitutional crisis? And if so, how seriously should we be taking it? What are your thoughts?
So I think there's definitely a critical historical moment, a very important historical moment. My reading of this article was I had a little bit of issue here. A few things. One, as you pointed out, the question is never asked in the article, can the left accept a loss? Right. Because if we assume, which is still an assumption, I would point out, but if we assume that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, the article does at least recognize that the Democratic side of the ticket sitting here today in October of 2021 doesn't look that strong. And so I don't know why we would immediately start overanalyzing the process that would unfold if Donald Trump lost the election and then, you know, didn't accept a loss. Because you can make a good argument sitting here right now today that were he the nominee, he would, you know, there's a decent likelihood that he could win, right? So you got to ask the question then, is the left, are Democrats ready to accept a Trump electoral victory? And what would be the sort of outgrowth of that? So that's one thing. The next thing that I would say is that some of the language in the piece, I think, over-dramatizes some of the Trump activity, which, again, I think anybody who listens to this podcast on a very regular basis, anybody who knows me, knows that I'm no fan of Donald Trump. There's a ton of stuff that Donald Trump does and says and represents that I don't agree with. But when you start saying that Donald Trump has forced people from office, right, it's it's important to point out that Donald Trump has not, like, gathered a group of paramilitary folks and, you know, kidnapped somebody or overtaken their office. If Donald Trump is going around and organizing people and making speeches and winning elections, you know, you have to decide for yourself if you think that's a good thing. You have to decide that for yourself. I leave that there. But to say that he's like forced people from office, I just feel like that language in this moment is a little misleading, because he's doing only things right now. I mean, he's going to court. He's making speeches. He's having rallies. He's doing electoral work. Those who want to see him not in power have to figure out how to do those same things, how to get folks on their side using their speech, using whatever avenues we have in the courts, using the electoral process to move that thing forward.
To be clear, though, Chris, real quick, but you would say, and I know you would say this, I just want to get it out, Trump did rely on intimidation and misinformation to unduly change the election results.
To attempt, which is my next point. He did use misinformation and intimidation to attempt to overturn the election results, which I would suggest, when the article says that he was just two states' attorney general and a vice president away from overturning the election, I would suggest that's a good distance, right? Two states' attorneys general and a vice president. I just see with this article, you have the Madison quote up front, and then you start making this argument, and you begin to see this idea that there are not enough states' attorneys general. There are enough people who are so you know, you look at somebody like Mike Pence. Like, Mike Pence was not like this super anti-Trump person, right? He was a person who had some fidelity to the Constitution, had some fidelity to his office. These two states' attorneys general, it's not like it was two states' attorneys general out of 50 who were under this intimidation and pressure. This was two states' attorneys general, you know, out of like four that were under this pressure. And really no state attorney general took the step of overturning their state's election. So to say that, oh, well, we're just a couple of states' attorneys general and a vice president away, that sounds really close when you write it in that sentence. But in reality, I feel like that's evidence that the system held up. And so to begin to suggest that we're in a place where our systems of government are in jeopardy of not being able to work, I don't think that's true. I think that what we have is a situation where we all need to be having conversations inside of our tribes and communities right now to bring the temperature down and get ready to fight hard in an election and then accept the outcome of that election, whichever way it goes.
Will people, do you feel like right now people will accept the outcome? Will Trump accept the outcome? Is there something to the idea that he's setting up to where he doesn't have to accept that?
I certainly think there is a situation in which he's trying to do that, which is a point that I think is really important for us to make, is that this is not like this question of sort of division, the partisan and tribal vitriol is not taking place in like this neutral environment where, you know, there's just something in the water and people are getting angry. Like, there are people and systems in our media and, sort of tech and social media places and our politics. There are people who have made their careers and are making their money off of our hatred of one another. And are using their significant influence in our culture to stir people's anger. And if there is a fight to be had, that's the other thing that I think when I read this article, I think it centers Trump a little too much, because I think that if there's a fight that we need to wage, it is against that very idea that we have to find ways to stop allowing folks who are making their money and making their careers off of everyday people hating other people. We have to stop them. We have to figure out a way to win back our own hearts and minds, and to regulate some of that platform and influence so that it's not as easy to put. I mean, this, for instance, the article that we're discussing, if we're honest, is mostly speculation and innuendo, but presented as almost like prophecy and sort of standard truth. And it is not that. But even discussing, like, the discussion around, oh, well, are we going to have a civil war, is what's going to get play in a lot of our outlets. And you and I can go out and try to have a conversation about, well, can we actually come together and heal our country? It's probably not going to end up like on the front page of the Washington Post right now. And I think that's the problem that we're facing. So is he trying to set it up where he doesn't have to, accept an electoral loss? He's certainly trying to set it up that way. I don't think that anybody's out in front trying to set it up where Democrats have to accept a loss. I think that we're also angling to make sure, you know, how many times you hear on, TV news and stuff, well, the electoral college, the popular vote and that kind of stuff. We're also seeding arguments, to make. And I think the main thing that we have to do is start trying to bring the temperature down right now. Those of us who think that that's a good thing need to be doing everything we can inside of our own tribes and parties to start to bring the temperature down. We have to work hard in the election, try to get the win for your side. That's what our democracy is about. But we need to start preparing ourselves to accept the opposite outcome wherever we are.
I'm with you on that. So you feel it's overblown. I'm with you in that I don't see our system just allowing Trump to do what he wants to do. Could he make it more difficult? Do we have to go through this whole, back and forth, steal the, yeah, we might have to go back through that. I also think you have the Supreme Court, which I do not think they're that far gone. They're not in Trump's pocket, regardless of what, sometimes progressives try to say. They're not going to just go along with him stealing an election or anything like that. So you still have that there as well. So I think the system holds up. I think the constitutional checks and balances prevents him from really, going any further. I do worry about, which you were just mentioning, I do worry about the mass violence. I do worry about the left and the right, the base, not accepting the outcome that they didn't want to see. And what happens from there, how long does that move forward? How much does the side that loses continue to undermine the system by saying somebody was cheating or saying, we don't like the Electoral College? And my thing with that is, you've got to change. It's been there. The Electoral College, that's the rules. That rule has been there. You can't act like you didn't know what the rules were just because you don't like the rule. So even somebody that's a Democrat, that's the rule. Until you change that rule, then that's what it is. And you can't say it's not cheating. It's not anything else. You were cool with it any other time, right? So if you want to fix it, then do that. Until then, you know what the rules are. You don't get to overturn an election or illegitimize an election based on something that you knew was there when you voted. So that's one way that, that's one way we have to look at it. But I want to jump back into what you were saying. What must Christians do? Because he's saying that there's not a constitutional remedy. We don't necessarily buy that it's into this huge constitutional crisis, that there has to be this fallout in the 2024 election. But let's say there isn't a constitutional remedy. There should be a remedy in the mind and in the civic engagement of the Christian. And this is, I think, what Chris was getting at. We have to commit to being peacemakers. And if you want to know what that means, look up our conversation on peacemakers that I think I did at the beginning of this year, or the end of last year on this podcast. We also have to agree, and this is what Chris said, and I'm all the way with him. We have to accept the results of the election unless somehow otherwise proven and adjudged by a court of law to be, otherwise. We have to accept the results of the election. And we have to hold our elected officials accountable to make sure our elected officials, especially the ones that are in elections, right, to make sure that they're not just political hires. We can do that now, right? We can look at, are these folks just political hires, or do they actually know what they're doing, right? And then we have to agree, we have to look at what we're retweeting, what messages we're putting out there. We have to be making sure that we're promoting healthy government, healthy discourse. And that's one of the things that we can do. Be prepared to lose if you lose. Be able to be a grown-up if you do lose and still be healthy and constructive with what we do. That's something that we can do, even if we cede the idea that there is no constitutional remedy for this. Chris, I'll let you take us out.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think one thing that the article, Kagan's article, sort of starts to get toward, I wish it would have been the emphasis of the article, but it does move toward this idea that there are things that we can do between here and 2024. As you say so rightly, there are things that we can do sort of in the populace. There is an opportunity for people in elected office to start to work together. I think that the article sort of suggests that Republicans need to go work with Democrats and just do, stuff that Democrats want to do. I think that there has to be give and take on both sides. But there is opportunity right now for elected leaders, for community leaders and grassroots leaders, for leaders and folks across the spectrum to start to work on this. Because I'm with you. I am concerned about mass violence. I think that I'm a little bit a few steps away from where the article seems to be, because I'm not ready to prefigure mass violence. There are a few years here in which we can be doing work. And I think that should be the emphasis.
If you're the mayor of or governor of mayor of Chicago, governor of Illinois, coming up to 2024, it looks like Trump is going to win. Are you preparing for mass violence?
If I'm the governor or the mayor and nothing has changed between now and that time, I certainly would be preparing for it. But if I'm the governor and the mayor of Chicago or Illinois right now today, I'm actually trying to find ways to have conversations in the community on two things. One, those folks are partisan. How do we organize to make sure that the outcome of the election is the one that we want to see? And not only how do we organize that, how do we legislate in a way that brings more people onto our side between here and there? But then to make sure that as one of the leaders in the party, one of the leaders in the community, that I'm starting to say right now today, we've got to work toward this because we want to win. It's not that we don't want to win, but we have to be prepared to fight as hard as we possibly can within the bounds of our democratic system of government, and then accept the outcome of the election. And every leader, before they ever have to think about, are they going to have to call up the National Guard, has an opportunity right now to start to do work to make sure that that doesn't have to happen.
And that's civic leaders as well. We can get so into talking about the bad things that are going to happen if the other side wins that we don't say to the people who are listening to us, you got to accept the outcome. Right? Because if we only talking about how everything's coming to an end and we see all the ads and everybody's going to be, their heads are going to be full of how life is over and the country is over if the other side wins. Somebody's got to be a grown up in the room enough to say, if we lose, You need to accept the outcome and be constructive.
Yeah. And I would say,
will we have that kind of leadership?
I think, you know, we saw this with Trump. It, when you don't do that, you actually sink the election, right? When you talk to people about the fact that you have to accept the outcome, that's how you get people to volunteer. That's how you get people to work. That's how you get people to come out and vote. If you set people up only to fight against an outcome that we don't like, the motivation is not necessarily to go win the election. The motivation is to fight the outcome of the election. So I think that both sides really need to take that into account, that this whole dance around, are we going to accept the outcome of the election, moves the focus of your base from actually winning the election.
Good stuff. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND Campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics, or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND Campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement. And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. By now, I'm sure that some of you have heard that Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who is an Arizona Democrat, last week, or I think it was this weekend, was videotaped and chased into a school bathroom over the weekend by pro-Biden. She's a Democrat, but she was chased into a bathroom by pro-Biden agenda activists who were confronting her over her objections that are holding up Biden's Build Back Better agenda. We have talked about this agenda several times. We talked about the reconciliation that's going through, how progressives and moderate Democrats are going back and forth. Sinema is kind of on that moderate side of the conversation, and people are upset. They're basically saying, hey, all the Democrats are on the same page. Why are you not going along with us? Now, for the sake of transparency and honesty, I'm not all that happy with Sinema either. And it's not just because she's not going along with the Democrats. It's because I think her motivations look to be compromised. Let me say that. This is a person who supported coming down on pharmaceutical prices. Now she, you know, apparently doesn't support that anymore. And it looks like she may have received some funds, not illegally, but from Big Pharma. These are the type of things that are going on. And so these people are upset. They chase her into a bathroom, meaning that she was fearful that she was going to be accosted or some, you know, that they were being way too aggressive, that she runs into this bathroom. I'm not very happy with Kyrsten Sinema right now. That is unacceptable. You're hearing about these parents on the conservative side. We have folks that are going to school board members' houses and yelling at them so much that they're trying to bring them out their houses. That's not where you do civic engagement. You don't go to somebody's private residence to do your civic engagement. You don't chase them anywhere into any bathroom or anywhere else. That's not how this works. And this goes into the conversation, Chris, and I know you know where we're going. It goes into a conversation about civility, because that's something, and we talk about it quite a bit, that's something that is really a pressing conversation right now. And one side would say, stop talking about civility, because sometimes civility, and this is true, I agree with this, sometimes civility is used to tell people to shut up, to tell people not to be passionate, to tell people not to speak as loudly as needed to be heard. So if you're going to be civil, I need you to just chill. Don't ever interrupt me. Don't be passionate. Don't say things in the wrong way. Make sure everything's about respectability politics. Be civil, which is sometimes just the powerful telling people to shut up. You're bothering me. You're a nuisance. I don't want to have to deal with it. I think it is wicked. Not only is it undemocratic, it is wicked to use a concept like civility to rob people of voice, to rob people of agency, to make it so that they're unheard. And in some cases, especially when it comes to the establishment, it comes to many times the conservative side of this conversation, and the majority side maybe is a better way to put it. Civility is weaponized against smaller groups. And what I would say is that's a distorted understanding of civility. Civility is not passivity. Civility is not being in the public square and making sure that you only say things in the way that a certain group wants you to say them, or that you never interrupt while I'm filibustering you, right? That's not civility. That's distorted. And that is a mechanism of powerful people trying to shut other people up. I truly believe that. But let me also say this, on the other hand, if incivility and therefore intimidation become the norm, the problem with that is that it also plays into the hand of the powerful. Because once you get rid of civility, then the rule is intimidation. And if I have the power, if I have the money and I have the guns, then I'm going to be able to intimidate you. And so it's always interesting to me, Chris, when I hear people who come from so-called, and I hate to use this term, but what you would consider weaker groups, right? Or smaller groups, groups that wouldn't have as much political power or as much economic power, right? Or social power or cultural power. It always surprises me when you hear these people say, kind of fight against civility. Because at the end of the day, if there's no civility, then you really have no voice. Now, what I think they're really saying is, I'm against this distorted view of civility, where you use civility to shut me up. But what I think we should be doing is fighting for a truer version of civility, not fighting against civility. Because in my estimation, Chris, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, true civility empowers weaker communities by giving them voice without having to overpower stronger, better financed, and all this other stuff to fight past those groups. It gives you the opportunity to speak. Civility gives the racial minority with a meritorious claim a voice. Civility gives the small woman with a big idea and an articulate viewpoint a voice. It gives the sexual minority with a persuasive testimony a voice where otherwise might is right and that rules the day. Civility is not your enemy. A distorted version of civility is your enemy. We should be fighting for a truer form. What happened to cinema was not cool. The other part of incivility, and we see it with the cinema conversation, is that it's not effective. It's counterproductive. It's basically a temper tantrum where you momentarily get out whatever emotion you want to get out. And then it ends up being counterproductive because now cinema's talking about I'm punching back. She's even madder and more set in her ways than she was before. Which is exactly usually what happens when you're not civil. It does not change people's minds unless you want to go all the way to violence, unless you want to go all the way to intimidation, where, again, you're playing into the hands of those who already have power. Let me know what it is, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that we have to continue to have this conversation about civility because I 100% agree that the subverted concept of civility would disempower weaker folks and weaker communities. I do think that there is some need for, I guess, thinking again about how we do protests. I think that if you hold the two things that you, Justin, were just talking about, this need and desire for true civility with the need and desire for effective protest, we actually end up in a healthy place. Because I personally, if somebody just told me, like, hey, we're going to chase a senator into we're going to follow a senator into the bathroom in protest. Just as I would with any other mechanism of protest, you have to ask the questions around, do you think, well, one, what's your goal, right? Like if your goal is just to get your face and your video on television and social media, then that's probably going to be effective. If your goal is to change Kyrsten Sinema's vote, an approach to legislation that you care about, you really have to ask yourself what part of that protest is going to give Sinema something that she wants or withhold from her something that she does not want. And I think usually if you go for effective protest, you are going to stay in safe spaces, because when you're thinking about effective protest, you're essentially, to go back to a phrase that you used earlier, which I really like, you're talking about how to persuade, not how to compel. And I think there is fairness in using protests as a means of persuasion. We are going to withhold from you something that you want, or prevent you from getting something, or put something on you that you do not want consistently until you change your vote. I just don't see where this particular protest was going to do this. If I were helping them organize, I'd be like, what you got to do is you got to have people outside of the senator's classroom every day. And they don't, at that point, they don't have to follow her in the bathroom, but they got to be there every single day. They got to make videos every day. They got to ask her that question every day and do it in such a way that the reason I would say don't follow her into the bathroom is frankly not because I see something, you know, where that particular tactic is 100% off limits in every case. I just think you made the bathroom the issue instead of your issue. Versus if you just did this every day until you start to win. Maybe she says something or does something that then she's the one that's looking bad or looking crazy. And I think when we're trying to get to this issue of civility, if we try to keep in mind what civility really is, and then try to keep in mind what's actually going to be effective forms of protest, we'll keep ourselves in a safe space. When we allow ourselves to start turning our protest into just an opportunity to be seen, for me as an organizer, that's really not what protest is really supposed to be about.
So your biggest issue is that it wasn't effective.
I think it wasn't civil, and I think that, but I think part of the reason.
So it wasn't civil. So you do agree. Because here's my thing. Civility can be disruptive. And that's the false sense of civility doesn't allow you to be disruptive. Civility can be disruptive. Again, it's not passivity. But there are important boundaries. And one of those boundaries are physical and privacy boundaries. And I think in both the types of protests that I brought up, they went past physical boundaries. And in the other instance, private residential boundaries, right? There's a public square. We talk about the public square. We're not talking about a private square. You have to be very careful when you have a bunch of people that are passionate of getting too close to somebody who you are protesting. Can you protest outside her classroom? Absolutely. Do you need to follow her when she leaves that area? And how closely can you follow her? Anybody who trains people for protest, trains people for civic engagement, if you don't train people to know those boundaries, then you're doing them a disservice. Because the civility creates, although it can be disruptive, it creates boundaries that protect human dignity, protect people in general, and support our agency. This is how it empowers you. Now, if you go up to her and there's any level of intimidation, if there's anything where she feels like she's not physically safe, at that point, you've exceeded those boundaries and you've done something that if the people with power do that to you, you're in trouble.
Yeah. And I think I agree with you on that. I think it's important to point out that when you become a public official, that concept of private space gets a little bit much. It gets a little bit more blurry than it is for like a straight private individual. I still think this particular thing was not civil, but I think that is really important. If people want to know how to remain civil, most of the stuff that is not civil is also not effective, right? Because usually if you are protesting, power doesn't protest, you know, like it has power and control. Right. So if you are in a space where you feel the need to protest, you are probably not going to win by being intimidating. You're probably not going to win by crossing those boundaries in a severe way. Really, protest should be trying to draw out the person you're protesting versus running across those boundaries. And yes, I think that the civility is the outcome that we're talking about. I think is a worthy outcome to discuss. But you can get yourself into a difficult headspace, I think, if you think about civility outside of the context of effectiveness. I think that effectiveness question is usually something that keeps you inside of the bounds on civility, because that stuff that is not civil usually is not good.
I think the bounds have to exceed just what's effective. I think there's a separation, because there could be, if you just say, hey, the bounds are when I get to what's not effective, then it's like, no, the bounds are there again to protect people physically, right? And to protect people in a lot of different ways, which may, I don't think, usually are effective, but I don't think you can tie the effectiveness and the boundaries all that closely. Because then it's like, well, it just, you know, the ends justify the means. As long as it's effective, then the boundary doesn't really exist if I can show it's effective. That I see where we could run into.
No, I think that's a good point that you're making, because the effectiveness, I think the civility question is the question that defines the boundaries. But I think that if your thought process when you're getting ready to set up a protest starts with effectiveness, you usually don't get anywhere close to the boundary. Civility is the boundary. Effectiveness can't be the boundary. You can't say, well, if it's the only reason we won't do it is if it is not effective. That's not what I'm saying. I think if it's not civil, you should not do it. But I think that if you actually start with effectiveness, you usually won't get anywhere close to the civility boundary, because most of the stuff that is not civil is not going to be effective. Because when you start doing that stuff that's not civil, you actually are moving into the tactics of oppressive power. And you don't even have it. So like, what are you doing?
If for those who aren't sold on civility, the argument at that for its own sake, right? The argument I make is that it's not effective. And we can see in this cinema conference, it's not effective. She's talking about now she's pushing back, and now she's even mad. You didn't do anything but have a temper tantrum. When you recorded her going to the bathroom, you got a viral tweet, but you didn't accomplish anything. It was counterproductive. And so that is an argument to make for a lot of people that they need to hear. But you can close this out.
Yeah, no, I think that this is a really, really important question, and I don't want to be perceived to be telling Christians or anybody else that you should and can do anything in protest as long as it is effective. That's certainly not what I am saying. I think we have to maintain civility. I will suggest, though, that if we focus on effectiveness, we usually won't get close to the civility boundary. If you find something that is both effective and not civil, still don't do it. But I think if you start with how do we win, how do we move the ball down the road, is usually, and we'll have a whole nother segment on protest, usually effective protest is going to cost you a little bit. You are going to come outside of your comfort zone a little bit, because it's usually something that's going to show the world your suffering, not show the world you trying to make somebody else suffer.
Your suffering is going, or your commitment and, you know, what you're giving up, your sacrifice is going to speak to somebody like cinema and the outside world. More than you chasing somebody into a bathroom, more than you going to their house and making sure they can't go to sleep at night. And so I think we definitely agree on most of
whoever's
that,
organizing it. Excellent. Justin just gave me a great idea for your protest. Instead of following Kyrsten Sinema into the bathroom, get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures of immigrants who have been affected by the policy that you're trying to protest. Show up at her classroom every day and hand out, give her one of those pictures, hand them out to her students, hand them out to other people around the university. Do it every day. Guarantee you, you're going to start to see more impact in your protest than chasing her to the bathroom. Free consulting.
Good stuff, man. That was big, man. This is one of our longest episodes, but I think it was long for a reason, and Camp, I hope you all enjoyed it. We're going to keep talking about this. Hey, there needs to be protests out there, but there needs to be boundaries. And ultimately, especially if you find yourself in a group that isn't powerless but doesn't have as much power as others, those boundaries of civility help you. All right. All right, and Camp, as usual, there is a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. We'll holla at you. Somebody say kingdom. Kingdom. Oh, Lord. I say kingdom.